Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This year marks the 50th anniversary of NPR's first transmission and the debut of All Things Considered. The new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR, is a group biography of four beloved women who fought sexism, covered decades of American news, and whose voices defined NPR. When National Public Radio came along in the 1970s and the door to serious journalism opened a crack, four remarkable women came along and, yeah, blew it off its hinges. Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki is by journalist Lisa Napoli. It's an account of these four women, their deep and enduring friendships, and the trails they blazed while becoming icons. It is a great pleasure to welcome Lisa Napoli to this week's book show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for writing this book. It's a fascinating history. What brought you to the subject?
Well, I'm a career journalist.
Yep.
My last book was about Ted Turner and the making of CNN.
That's right.
And CNN turned 40, and it happened to be the place where I started my career as a kid. And I look in that book at the transformation of the cable news and the television news landscape because of Ted Turner and CNN. So when I was done with that, I needed to figure out what I was going to do next. And my editor, who happened to have been born in 1980, the same year that CNN started, said, I know you want to write a biography. And Koki Roberts had just passed away. So this was in September 2019. And he said, would you write a biography of Koki Roberts? And that seemed daunting, and I don't know, I couldn't grok that. So I started rooting around, sorry for the long answer, and I realized that NPR was about to turn 50, and I knew from having worked in public radio myself that these four women were known as the founding mothers, and I started kind of triangulating all of that, as you do when you start writing these books, as you do when you start telling a story. And I realized that would be a really interesting story to tell it through the lens of these four women who were there at the beginning and to look at the genesis of NPR, because so many people listen to it and love it, and some people don't love it, but everybody knows about it now. How did it get to be what it is? So that's how it happened.
They were there at the beginning, but that was all accidental, wasn't
yes.
it? I mean, that was not a plan there anyway. They all sort of came in at different times under different guises, and
yes.
then they were all together.
Absolutely. No, and that's what was also so interesting for me, too, having just written this Ted Turner story. Ted Turner wasn't into news. I mean, he wasn't really a broadcaster. It was all a lot of accidents that created the first all-news channel, cable channel. And it was the same sort of thing with NPR. There were people behind National Public Radio who loved radio and believed in it. But just as public broadcasting was coming onto the stage, these four women were in this strange position that many women found themselves in that time in the 70s, which was unable to get good jobs because people didn't take them seriously. But yes, each one of them entered at a different moment in time for the network, Susan and Linda at the beginning, Nina a little bit later, and Koki later in the decade. And that just helps unfold the story of how NPR got to be NPR.
Susan Stamberg,
mm-hmm.
Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, and Koki Roberts. What did these women want out of their careers? Because they were all, I would say, at least in two cases, were of means, mm-hmm. and otherwise they had access to very good education.
The journalism and the world, were all completely different then, of course, 40, 50 years ago than they are today. These were women who, as you say, three of them went to super colleges. One of them, Nina Totenberg, went to a great college and dropped out. But they all, as different as their stories were, and this is what I found so interesting, they all wanted to apply their brains to their work, even though Koki Roberts, at the beginning of her working life, didn't really want a career as much as she wanted a family. But each one of them wanted to find a way to tell stories. They just were naturally born storytellers. And it was really hard for them to get jobs. And so that's why the fact that NPR was a startup literally at that time in the 70s, and very few people wanted to work there, much less knew about it to want to work there. And radio was this sort of left for the dead medium because television was right. The show at the time. All those things conspired together to kind of make it a ripe moment in time for them.
Talk a little about, you spend a good portion of the book talking about this history of not only NPR, but of equal rights and the movement at that time and what was changing. But give us a sense of how revolutionary this was, NPR, because it starts with President Johnson, who, oh, by the way, went to Cokie Roberts' wedding, which I just think is a really cool aspect of the story. And it ends up where you have this, it's always fighting for funding, it's always fighting for its life. The picture you paint in the book for much of it is a very, as an organization, very much in disarray. Mm-hmm. And yet these women come together and do a tremendous job. But what was it about NPR that was so different, because it kept on trying to find out what it was going to be good at?
That's what I love about this story, and I love about origin stories, is that the iconic things that we take for granted, and people who we take for granted in contemporary society, had to start somewhere. And what's so interesting is that NPR was born out of this real concern about commercial media, television mostly, that it had this stranglehold on the American mind share, and how could they open it up, diversify it, a lot of what we talk about today. And the idea that this radio network, initially it wasn't even really a network, it was more of a service, was started to create programming that was alternative to what people could get in commercial media. But it was like most startups as we think of today, it was unformed. Nobody, you know, we call it in the internet business the soft launch. Nobody had a fully formed idea that it was going to become what people take for granted NPR is today. It was just the idea that we needed to revivify radio and create a service that got pumped out around the nation to places that didn't normally get robust programming. So it was a series of accidents and a lot of experimentation, which is why it is always interesting to look at the beginning of something. I covered the internet for the New York Times at the turn of the last century, which was such an exciting time to do that because it was just coming up in, you know, the web was just coming up in mindshare. And of course, after a while, it just became a utility. It wasn't as interesting to talk about. But that's why this is such an interesting moment in time, because it's about this nail-biting first 12 or 13 years of this service, which became a network, and how it kind of righted itself as it wobbled around in the very beginning.
I have worked in public radio for 26 years. I've been a fan of public radio since its inception, and I've obviously been in love with radio all my life. What I was surprised about, you surprised me a couple times in this book.
Oh, good.
But one of the things that really surprised me was that you forget, FM really had to fight for its life.
Yes. This
was not something that that people were ready for. You have basically a dying medium of radio because television had taken over. AM was 50,000 open,
powerful,
clear channel, powerful. You could hear KMOX in St. Louis, in Philadelphia, and Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
However, FM comes on the scene, and it's really, they kind of gave away these educational frequencies, and that has to come out and say, okay, not only are we building the startup of National Public Radio, but we're building up what is commercial radio.
Right. And that's what's also so interesting to me, because I didn't know this either until I started researching this book, that there were these little stations affiliated with universities, mostly universities. Right. In some cases, they were school districts. In California, where I live, Santa Monica KCRW was licensed initially to a junior high school. And it was really just an experiment and a public service and an extension of the schools to which that was licensed. And FM came along and allowed for this really exciting movement, but that's what I'm writing about here in this book, is how this really exciting movement was largely, not entirely, spearheaded by these few devoted people, among them these women, who saw the potential for, in some cases, some people did see the commercial potential of this FM frequency.
Lisa Napoli is our guest on this week's book show, the new volume, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. When I was preparing for this interview, there's a point, like a regular, like a Broadway show, where you know you have to set it in your mind and say, okay, this is all I can cram in my brain for this interview, which is what I did. But while I was driving over here today, the only thing I was thinking about was, I wonder if Lisa sat down and said, Linda, Nina, Susan, Cokie? Oh, let's lead with Cokie, we'll end with Nina.
It's funny, people ask me that everywhere I go.
I'm fascinated.
So glad that you asked that, because it is a really interesting, I hope it's a really interesting answer. So with these four women, of course, Cokie could be arguably considered the most famous because she did go to television and wrote huge best-selling books and is deceased, and that made the news.
And her Nina, family
was a storied congressional family. Right, exactly. Both her mother and her father served in Congress for decades. And Nina, you could have led with Nina because she's most contemporarily famous, if that's a word. She's on the air every day. Everybody knows Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she's just active. But I chose Susan to go with first, even though Linda technically was the very first employee of National Public Radio by a month in 1971. But I chose Susan because Susan had worked in public radio before any of those other people, in educational radio, before anybody else had. She's a little bit older than the other three women, who are all about the same age. And because she was the very first co-host of NPR to break out and become famous. So some people may not remember, she's still on the air now, or I guess she's not as much on the air since the pandemic, but she still contributes. But people who are hardcore public radio fans from way back when, before public radio was big, know who Susan Stambrook was. She is the person whose voice put public radio on the map. She really is the founding mother of the founding mothers.
She comes in and has such this relaxed conversational style, which not only becomes her trademark, but really becomes the trademark of National Public Radio.
Yes.
And of the sound of NPR that many of us mimic even today. What I thought was interesting in your telling of this story is that mostly the men who were complaining, but were saying, well, it's too trite. You're talking about this. We have to talk about these serious things, and you make it sound a little too homey, a little too hokey. But what was she onto of understanding that this is what people cared about?
Well, she was onto it just because she was naturally wired to have conversations with people and naturally wired to be curious and herself. She couldn't read scripts. It was really hard for her. I mean, she could literally read scripts, but she was just wired to sit down and do what you're doing with me now, which is just talk. But we have to give credit to a man named Bill Siemering, who'd come from WBFO in Buffalo before he came to be the founding programming director of National Public Radio. And his vision, if you can have a vision in radio, was that radio, that public radio must not sound like commercial radio, which is this voice from the mountaintop, I have a terrific voice and I'm going to read the script and I'm going to just speak in a scripted way very well. He wanted something that sounded completely different, and that the mentality behind it needed to be completely different, that it wasn't wasn't rat-a-tat news, news radio in the classic sense, which there was a lot of at that point. That was mostly what you would hear on commercial radio. So he sat everybody down that first couple of months of NPR and said, we don't want to sound like these guys. We want to sound natural. And they struggled to find somebody who could do that because the few people who were trained in radio had come from that world, that, you know, give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world kind of mentality.
Right.
And so when she substituted the young producer, Jack Mitchell, who was producing the show, at that point, basically said, aha, that's what we want to sound like. That sound, that humane conversational sound is what we want to mimic and what we need to mimic, and that they'd had a hard time doing up until then.
We should note that Bill Simmering, you dedicate the book to him.
Yeah, I do.
Very much one of the founding fathers of NPR, later worked very closely with Terry Gross at WHYY.
Yes. Yeah, he's an essential character, although he is so self-effacing that he's mortified when you say that.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate that I met him years ago when I worked at the Public Radio Marketplace, and I left to go to Bhutan to help start a radio station there. And Bill, after his work with Terry Gross and with Susan and Linda at the beginning of NPR, and with many, you know, on the board of NPR, very involved in public radio, he had gone on and won a genius grant for his work in developing nations, helping them see the power of radio, especially non-commercial radio. And so when I went to Bhutan, someone said, you got to meet Bill Simmering. So I called him up and we became friends, and I'm honored to have had many conversations with him about all of this, but particularly about the power of radio in a community.
Linda Wertheimer comes into this story, and it's because she ends up hosting as well.
Yes.
Susan Stamberg is the first regular host of All Things Considered, and then in comes Linda Wertheimer afterwards.
Yes.
Her road to that is fascinating because she's just an on-the-street, really good reporter.
Exactly. And I like Linda's and Susan's story so much because it mimics mine. You know, I didn't come from a fancy family. I just always knew I had this natural curiosity for things. And Linda had grown up as the daughter of a grocer in Carlsbad, New Mexico. And because she was so whip smart, got a scholarship, a National Merit Scholarship. And someone talked her into going to the best college she could get into, which turned out to be Wellesley. And even though that was a scary thing to do for a woman in the 60s who'd never been that far east before, she came east, and that sparked her ambition to work in the news business. But she came up against this problem that we alluded to earlier, which was that women couldn't get jobs in the news business except as researchers or secretaries. She makes her way to NPR and just is such a terrific student that she learns everything there is to know about, at first, consumer reporting in the era of Ralph Nader, for anybody who remembers that. And then she studies up on Congress and is able to do that kind of reporting, too, deftly, not like a lot of people do now, which is superficially. She was really deep into it. So, yeah, and then ultimately became a host, too. So her story is really interesting.
One of the things I love about this story is these four women that you write about, there's little or no competition. They're there. They're doing their thing.
Yes.
They all have their places. And as they evolve and as NPR evolves, they become closer and closer and closer.
Yes.
It's Linda and Cokie who basically have this partnership where they're out because Cokie is hired as the last one in 77, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're out getting the stories.
Well, it's so interesting that Cokie grew up in this congressional family. She, you know, as Linda said, she was born in the boiler room of Congress, and she got married and went off and had a life and came to Washington. She didn't want to come back to Washington, winds up getting this job at NPR, covering other stuff. But Linda says, you know so much about Congress, you should be covering it. Even though Linda was covering it herself, she should have wanted to throw this Cokie woman under the bus because who wouldn't be threatened by somebody who had innate contacts and knowledge of Capitol Hill. But instead, as you point out, and a lot of people find this hard to believe, and it probably would not happen today, that these two women forged this partnership, this alliance. And it was largely, Linda credits Cokie with just being such a collegial person. First, Cokie didn't want to do it. Linda talked her into it, and then they did this work together. They tag-teamed this coverage. Now, for somebody listening to this who doesn't understand the historical context, it was incredibly unusual for people to be covering the Hill the way broadcasters, these broadcasters did, much less for women to be running around the Hill wielding microphones. It just didn't happen. So it made it even more unusual that you had these two women who covered politics, not just Capitol Hill, because that was just not a common thing then.
Which brings us to Nina Totenberg. Her beat really always naturally was the legal beat of following the courts. What you just said of how unusual it was, she would get these amazing scoops and people would just assume that she was sleeping with somebody.
Exactly, right. I mean, that would imagine saying that today about a reporter of any gender. Yeah.
Right.
So Nina's story is also fascinating because people think that, you know, if you listen to her today, which if you're listening to this, you probably do, you probably assume that she's got some sort of legal background, legal education. She doesn't. She just naturally loved covering the Supreme Court, and she invented this way of taking extremely detailed, some might say dry, information and making it into theater that, by the way, is factually correct, making this theater out of it, making it consumable by the masses. But what's also so interesting about that is that she came from print, and the idea that a broadcaster would be immersed in the Supreme Court in the 70s or 80s was incredibly unusual. There wasn't as much airtime then. And the idea that you would do anything more than read a headline about a major Supreme Court decision was extremely unusual. But it was single-handedly Nina who created this way of talking about legal issues. And, you know, what happens when she's gone is anybody's guess, because who could step in and repeat what she does? It's incredible. But she literally invented it.
I asked about the competition aspect of it. So I'm going to craft a shaggy question, if you don't mind.
Please.
These were four women who were not, as we noted, competitive with each other. They were also not competitive with other women who were out there working in other venues, to say. And eventually they become, there's the good old boy network, and they become the good old girl network.
Yes. I mean, they, and again, that's something that's not so surprising today. If I told you that, you know, women got together and helped support one another, you'd say, of course they do. Or the people got together and did that. But they innately recognized that if there was this old boys network, which of course there was, that there needed to be an old girls network. And who better than they to spirit it, because, you know, at NPR, they very quickly became the elder statespeople because they were just there from the virtual beginning. Two of them were, the others came on. And so as the place grew, they had the institutional knowledge about the place. But around DC, as more women cracked into the profession, and of course, so many doors opened as there was more airtime and as the social mores and the challenges to those mores, you know, yielded much more of an open-minded world. So yeah, they recognized that they had this power and they didn't want to leave it on the table. So they basically made it their business to help other people, whether they were looking for partners, life partners, or whether they were looking for jobs. And so they were den mothers, if you will, although some people might see that as pejorative. But they wouldn't. They would totally call themselves that. They felt their responsibility.
You tell a lovely anecdote in the book about Mary Louise Kelly, who received notes from Cokie Roberts, and upon Cokie's death, she said, you know, she was always there for me. She was writing these notes, only to find out that Cokie did that for a
everybody.
Lot of people. Yeah. which is really beautiful to think of.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, I love this story for so many reasons, particularly for people who don't know who some of the women I've written about are. I think it's really important for younger people to understand what it used to be like for all of us, women and men, decades ago, but also to see the collegiality that they seem to have baked in them.
You look at these four dynamic women and how they become icons of public radio. And yet, here is a radio network that has its share of troubles and is, as I mentioned before, continually having money woes and has most recently had really a hell of a Me Too scandal, not only within its ranks nationally, but within the member stations and the people who are providing much of the content that is heard on NPR. So what is their legacy in that, in the sense of the fact, at least I kept thinking, why don't they just take over?
That's what I kept wondering too. Can you imagine? I mean, there's no better advocate for public radio than Susan Stamberg,
right,
who is, you know, just to this day in her 80s, not even, you know, working there full time, the most incredible, passionate, and knowledgeable person about public radio that there is. You know, it's a good question, and it's a hard question, and it's not an easy answer because, look, everything in our world, it doesn't go straight up or straight down. It kind of undulates. And that's what I love about this story. It's about the near financial collapse of this network, this really scandalous period of time in its early history, wrapped around the story of these women and how they entered the network. And it's just, there is no simple solution to any of this, but what's important is for all of us to keep talking about it and to look at history because, you know, all these things repeat themselves. The issues that happen are things that have happened over time. The women, I wish they had run the place. They were passionate about telling the stories themselves. Yes, if some of them had run it, would it have avoided financial issues? Would it have avoided what we call Me Too issues today? Would it have been a more diverse staff? I mean, Bill Siemering, back in 1971, wanted to hire an African-American co-host right out of the gate as NPR started. And now, of course, we talk about the diversity issue all the time. So it's just so interesting that everything, the more things change, the more things stay the same and recast themselves. I guess I'm not giving you a real answer. Because
no, that's
there
a,
is,
I think that's a good, I mean, it's a hard, as you say, it's almost an impossible question. Lisa Napoli's new book is Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. It is published by Abrams Press. Lisa, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Our thanks to The Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts, edithwharton.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program, Book Marcus, for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.